Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and tonight's conversation is with Tom Fox, Assistant Administrator for Policy and Program Coordination at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And joining me is Kevin Bacon, also a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Well, Tom, we left the last segment talk about managing for results, and one of the things I've always been curious about is how do you measure the results of our foreign aid?
There are two issues here. One is how do we measure how we do in a given country, in a given activity, and the second is how do you aggregate it in a way that people can understand it and get some overall vision of how effective our foreign aid program is. On the first, we do have in every country, each of our programs has three or four, say, strategic objectives that they are managing against and that they are devoting resources to. They establish targets that are annual targets and then targets at the end of the activity, which it could be 5 years, 7 years, whatever. And they measure it every year carefully and then self-report. And we sometimes go back and double-check from Washington. But by and large, we are usually doing pretty well against what our performance measurements were, like how many schools have been strengthened in this or that way, to what degree has primary school enrollment increased in a given region where we are active, and that sort of thing. That the aggregation problem is much, much more difficult because there are so many factors that influence the big picture other than simply what we are doing. I just came back from a conference in Dakar in Senegal last week, which was called Education for All, a big international conference where everybody got together and reviewed what are the overall targets that were established by the foreign assistance community several years ago. And among them is to eliminate the distinction between girls and boys enrollment in primary schools by the year 2005 and to allow for access to education, primary school education, for everybody by the year 2015. Yeah. And so this group came together and said, why aren't we making better progress toward that objective? We can point to what we've done in a given country and to many different countries and see progress in several of those countries. But to meet the overall target that the community of development agencies working with developing countries have established is a much more complicated question because there's so many factors that we have no control over whatsoever. For instance, that includes, in our case, those figures include primary school education in China. We have no program in China. So that the aggregation problem is a very serious one. We can point to lots of general successes and know that we had a huge role in it, that Thailand is no longer considered a developing country, Korea is no longer considered a developing country, Costa Rica, on and on and on. There are a number of stories where we had a major role in helping that country achieve a middle-income category. And we can also point to a number where we've had huge successes in terms of something like how many women now have access to contraceptives and can thereby make their own choices about the rate at which they're going to increase the size of their families. But again, to add that all up on a global level so we can say what's happening in the whole world and have that be influenced by this or that conflict, this or that war, this or that drought, which of course just wipes away things, it's very, very difficult to do.
You know, one of the key aspects of any organization are the people who work in the organization. And I'd be interested in your thoughts about the employees at USAID. How are they expected to be different today than they were perhaps a decade ago? And what kind of, looking forward, what kinds of knowledge, skills, and abilities are the people who work for aid going to need to help you achieve your, very ambitious, goals that we've set for our foreign assistance program?
There's been a lot of evolution over the years. I would say 20 years ago, AID was dominated by people that had not only good sort of generalist programming skills, but also had particular technical capacity, technical skills. They, in most cases, were the primary provider of the cohesive development message or technical capacity. That's not the case today anymore. Largely, the the technical capacity that AID delivers comes through other organizations that we enable, that we support, that we complement.
To use contracting or other kinds
or
of grants.
Or universities or nonprofit organizations or whatever, so that our staff are now much more enablers for the provision of technical assistance. They're enablers and they are synthesizers. They are also the vehicle by which the technical cooperation, the technical assistance is used in policy dialogue. In other words, our staff will play the role of talking with the local government about what the implications might be for their policies and their institutions. Mm-hmm. So it means that the staff is much less technical than it was and much more involved in the skills of enabling.
So they have to have much better partnering skills, management
skills. No question. Our staff is also substantially smaller. That is, the career staff is much smaller than it was
how much
several
has
years
it,
ago.
Has
well,
it
we've lost 35% in the last 7 years. I'm not sure exactly. It's roughly that figure and roughly mm-hmm. that time frame. So that our reliance, therefore, on contract staff and on associations through grants with universities and nonprofits is much greater than it was. That's a strength, too. Because we are tapping expertise mm-hmm. Of many organizations that
it would be hard for you to gather
that
all
we,
of that
we can't
your...
gather. That's correct. So there's a strength in that evolution, without any doubt whatsoever. There are still functions that only a government employee can perform, can sign something, and that sort of thing. So that we have to still have that capacity, mm-hmm. and we also need to have the memory that permanent career staff provides. That's terribly important. Otherwise, you just lose the capacity to learn from what you did 3 years ago.
With the shrinkage of your permanent staff, which is something other government agencies, other federal agencies have experienced as well, I imagine that's really limited your ability to recruit new people into the agency.
No question, because we are not expanding. If anything, we are contracting a little bit every year, and we are. Mm-hmm. It means that it's very difficult for us to recruit. We have made a very conscious effort in the last 2 years to recruit young Foreign Service officers, and last year was the first year that we brought in a significant number of people, mm-hmm. and we're giving that a very, very high priority. There's still a number of really, really fine people that want to work for AID and go overseas. It's a more competitive market because there are lots of other ways by which people can go overseas or have an international career rather than just work for the government, unlike what it was 30 years ago when mm-hmm. I started in this business. So there is much more competition with the private sector in particular for good, strong people.
And that was a question I was going to ask you. What's drawing these people to government service? Because as we hear, there's tremendous opportunities. I guess I wasn't surprised to learn that you virtually began in the Peace Corps. Yet, I think a long time ago, a lot of people went to the Peace Corps quite early, and it was a very almost patriotic thing to do. And now I'm not so certain people are talking about it that much anymore. So I am sort of curious what's drawing people.
You know, altruism is still alive and well. It's not talked about enough, but it's still alive and well. There are a lot of people that are very motivated by simply doing what they believe is the right thing. And the right thing corresponds to that first argument that I used about why people support aid, that it reflects values and so forth, a vision of what we want American leadership to be, that it's more than simply economic and military muscle. And influence it, and ideas. It's also a generosity that is in our self-interest and so forth. And I think a lot of people are very motivated that way and can only express that through either government service or through nonprofit organizations. And so there's always going to be a community of people that feel that way and are motivated for that reason.
And how about just the sheer numbers of the way it worked. I mean, there was very little hiring, perhaps even none for quite some time. You might even say a generation of employees. And so if AID is like elsewhere, a number of people are getting ready to retire and there's no real team coming up behind them and there's a much younger group right behind them.
You're absolutely right. And that is indeed the issue. And the one that we have moved very, very aggressively on in the last couple of years to try to build up as fast as we possibly can a younger generation. We didn't lose a generation, but we lost a few years. And as a result, particularly the Foreign Service employees of AID, which is it's not the majority of the direct hire because most of the people back here in Washington are more likely to be civil service. But having a Foreign Service that was getting increasingly old and closer to retirement without a corresponding class or generation of people to catch up with them and replace them was a dangerous situation. I think we've caught it in time. And we're just getting some outstanding people because we can offer them a very exciting career.
Great. It's time for a break. We'll be right back with more of the Business of Government Hour.